Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm Jon Favreau.
I'm Dan Pfeiffer.
I'm Erin Ryan.
Later in the pod, you'll hear my interview with Katie Couric, who's got a new podcast documentary reflecting on the interview she did with Sarah Palin 10 years ago. Oh, and that was the craziest thing that happened. So a few other quick housekeeping things before we get into the news. On Pod Save the World this week, Tommy chatted with The Atlantic's Natasha Bertrand about the uncertainty over Rod Rosenstein's tenure in the Trump administration. I have a plug here for Hysteria, but Erin, you're here.
I'm here.
What's on Hysteria this week?
So we had to record Hysteria on Wednesday, which was before the madness of today. So, but one thing that was cool about this week is that we were able to highlight four really exciting female candidates instead of like dwelling on the super dark news. So we got to talk about Lucy McBath, Gina Ortiz-Jones, a couple other candidates you might be excited about. Between now and the election, we'll probably be highlighting.
That's awesome.
Women that are running, especially in flippable districts, especially young women, women of color, and women running with non-traditional backstories. So
that's excellent.
Trying to keep it light.
Something hopeful.
Yeah.
Also, everyone, tickets are now available for the shows that we will be doing for our HBO special, which will be in Miami. Erin will be with us in Miami.
Yay.
Austin, Philadelphia, and Irvine. And so you can check out this website, www.theblacklistnyc.com/PSA. Check that out for tickets to the HBO shows. Okay. We are recording this during the Kavanaugh-Ford hearing today. And we're recording this basically right after Lindsey Graham lost his mind during the questioning of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. So that's in the second half of the hearing. And then we decided, it's 2 p.m. now, 2:30 p.m. now on Thursday. We've been watching this since 7 a.m. All three of us have been in the office watching this with everyone else. I think just to start, what an awful day. It is probably the craziest political event I have witnessed since Trump won the election. I don't know. At least that's how I feel right now. I guess let's start with initial reactions of Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony and questioning, and then we can move on to Kavanaugh. Erin, what were your initial reactions watching Dr. Christine Blasey Ford this morning?
Well, I think that a lot of women watching this kind of went through similar series of emotions that I went through. It's incredibly difficult as a woman to watch this unfold over and over again, to look at another round of headlines that have to do with sexual assault, to watch another woman basically have to kind of dissect herself in front of the world to prove what happened to her. A lot of friends of mine texted me this morning saying they were getting emotional watching. This was very difficult for them. I felt watching her that she was incredibly brave in ways that I couldn't imagine being brave. Her voice wavered, but she kept it together. She was very straightforward and fact-based. She acted in a way that is unfortunately like the standard that women who try to make a point, who try to be believed, need to adhere to. Men like Lindsey Graham, like you mentioned, can throw tantrums and scream into the camera and complain and whine, and that's totally fine because they're men and they have gravitas. But the pressure on Ford was a lot higher than it would be on a man, because women need to act more rational and calm in order to be thought of as rational and calm as a man. So I was really impressed with her, her composure, her calmness, or her calm. But I was also very upset by the fact that we had to revisit those issues again as women, yet again.
I thought the same thing about her bravery. Like, I found myself teary through watching the testimony and watching her statement. And I was like, and I'm not even, like, I can't imagine what she's going through right now, what she was going through, and how she kept it together the whole time. And she was so poised and so forceful and incredible in her testimony. Dan, what did you think?
I agree with that. You cannot be a rational person and watch her put herself before the nation and give that testimony about this incredibly traumatic experience that happened to her and believe that this is part of some sort of democratic plot to unseat Brett Kavanaugh or tilt the Supreme Court. I think it was, I mean, obviously her testimony was incredibly compelling, and but it's also, it just was sad because this is such an incredibly serious thing, and we live in a political world where one of our parties is incapable of acting with the seriousness and the compassion and the empathy that you would expect in this situation or would hope for in this situation.
Yeah, I kept thinking, like, after listening to her testimony and listening to her after everyone questioned her, like, it just comes back to you either believe her account or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't believe it, you should ask yourself, why? Why would she put herself through what she had to put herself through today? Why would she put her family through that? What did she have to gain? What incentive did she have to do this today?
Yeah, that's something I was thinking a lot about. And I was thinking it's sort of a kind of it's a different version of a thing that women go through a lot, I think. When a woman is, in a lot of cases, when she's sexually assaulted or victimized by a guy, that's something that sticks with her for the rest of her life, you know? Dr. Ford has obviously been thinking about this thing that happened to her when she was a teenager since it happened, like to the extent that it impacted remodeling that she was doing on her home after she'd been married decades later. And that's the thing. That's like women carry this with them forever. And one thing that I was thinking just as the day went on is that, you know, Brett Kavanaugh has performed believing that he didn't do this. Like he has performed believing that this thing happened to her, but he maybe doesn't remember. And I just think that it's sort of the way that it's happened for a lot of women is that something will happen to them and it'll be something they think about every day for the rest of their lives. And then the guy just doesn't have to live with it. He just doesn't think about it. It goes away for him.
I think that says as much about the situation as anything is that the most traumatic experience of Dr. Blasey Ford's life is something that Brett Kavanaugh doesn't even remember. Could just be any other Saturday night or Friday night in his high school career. And I think it's a microcosm of what we're dealing with in this country on these issues.
Mm-hmm.
The level of detail in her testimony, you mentioned in the front door, you know, and she said that when they were remodeling their home, she wanted to have two front doors, and she, you know, got in a fight with her husband about this and other people who were working on the house, and no one could understand why she wanted the second door. And that's how she ended up when she was in couples therapy with her husband, bringing up the incident for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You have her bring this up in 2012 in a therapy session. You have four sworn statements from friends of hers that she brought this up with them over the years. And then we found, you know, as we learned today, she brought this up to her representatives before Kavanaugh was nominated for the court. I think I saw Chris Hayes tweet about this, but he was saying basically she was trying to do the White House's vetting for them. And she said a couple times during that testimony, I was hoping, I was praying they would go for an equally qualified conservative nominee for the court and not Kavanaugh. And when I thought that they weren't going to do that, when I was worried about it, I started coming forward because I thought he might end up being the one. So like none of that points to the fact that she might have made this up somehow.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. A lot of times when we talk about sexual assault, people say that women lie about it. And, you know, I think that if people are fucked up enough to sexually assault each other, there are people that would be fucked up enough to lie about it.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the way that I think that most of the lies around sexual assault happen. If you're a woman that has had it happen to you, you have to lie about it so that you can get through the rest of your life. You have to lie about how big of a deal it was to you. You have to lie about your ability to overcome it without intervention. And I think men who do it lie about it too. They lie about it so they can tell themselves that they're the sort of person who doesn't rape people.
Yeah.
They need to rewrite history as it's happening. We've talked about this on Hysteria. A lot of, you know, some of my co-hosts have had interactions with men that were definitely not okay, where a man tried to overpower you or a man tried to do something to you that wasn't okay. And in my case, at least, the guy who tried to do it to me reached out to me years later to like friend request me on Facebook and was like, hey, how's it going? It's been so great to see your success. Like, to me, that was me witnessing him trying to pretend that that hadn't happened. Yeah. And I think that that is the biggest lie around sexual assault. People needing to pretend that it didn't happen so that they can believe what they believe about what kind of person they are. And Brett Kavanaugh clearly has an idea of what kind of person he is. He's the captain of the basketball team. He got into Yale. He went to parties and just had a good time. He drank a lot of beer. He's not the kind of person who ruined someone's life. He needs to not believe he's that person.
And we'll get to sort of his side of this whole hearing later, but you could sort of tell, you could tell that in his anger and his testimony too, right? That in his mind, he's like, and he kept saying this over and over, I've been through so many FBI investigations. I've been so public for so long. I've gotten this far. I'm a good father. I'm a basketball coach. And you can tell he genuinely believes all those things to be true. And it's possible that all those things are true and he's still sexually assaulted Dr. Blasey Ford. You know, like, I think he's trying to set up the situation. The Republicans are like, oh, everyone's trying to paint this guy as an evil monster his whole life. And he's not. He's this good guy. But it seems like it's much more complicated than that.
It's absolutely more, because people are more complicated than that. Because here's the thing. People can evolve and people can change and people can behave in ways that are abhorrent when they're under the influence of alcohol or drugs. And as they mature, they can move away from being the sort of person who would do that kind of thing. But I also think that it would be less difficult for me to accept if Brett Kavanaugh were the sort of person who believed in those qualities from other people. His judicial record, for example, doesn't in any way support the idea that people deserve redemption for mistakes they made when they were teenagers. You know, he was a person who on the D.C. circuit pushed for an undocumented teen to not be able to obtain an abortion.
Yeah.
After she had met all the legal requirements set forth by Texas law. You know, the GOP is the party of mandatory minimum sentencing for underage drug offenders. The GOP is the party of mandating pregnant teens carry pregnancies to term. I think that if Kavanaugh in any way exhibited the forgiveness that he wants the world to give him now, that would be something that would maybe move me a little bit, but yeah. He hasn't.
Yeah, he's incapable of experiencing any divergence from his personal narrative about himself. And there's been zero self-examination about any mistakes he has made in his life, either just even beyond this specific allegation, just about being an asshole 17-year-old, which many 17-year-olds can be, being obnoxious to other people, drinking too much. And just every single time he refuses to acknowledge any fault on himself, which raises real questions about his larger denials. Because if you lie about the small things repeatedly, it suggests that you would also lie about the big things.
Yeah. We were all, of course, texting about this all day, and Anna Marie Cox was saying catchable lies. That's what he keeps telling, these catchable lies. And that is the story of the entire confirmation process with him from beginning to end, whether it's about, and we've said this a million times on this podcast, whether it's about, you know, receiving stolen documents during that hearing, whether it's his opening statement about how, you know, Trump has never consulted more people for any position ever. And today, small things in his yearbook, right? Like, it's just all these little lies that are easily proven false that he keeps telling, which tells you that there is a credibility issue at stake here. There's two people here. There's Dr. Ford and there's Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh has been caught in dozens of lies already, big and small, and she has not been. So the Republicans had an Arizona prosecutor named Rachel Mitchell handle the questions for the Republicans to Dr. Ford. Because they didn't like the, understandably, optics of, 11 men on the Judiciary Committee, 11 Republican men questioning Dr. Ford.
The Republicans have never had a woman on the Judiciary Committee in the hundreds of years of Judiciary Committees.
That's correct. So they had an Arizona prosecutor named Rachel Mitchell, who, you know, her background is in prosecuting sex crimes. She handled the questions for Dr. Ford. What did we think of that? How did that go?
Well, it depends on what you're interested in getting out of this hearing. If you're interested in her prosecuting a woman who says that she experienced sexual assault in the same way that she would prosecute someone accused of sexual assault, then you didn't get what you wanted. I saw people on Twitter saying that she essentially subjected Dr. Ford to a standard intake like a standard series of intake questions that you would ask a sexual assault survivor, but just in 5-minute chunks interrupted by Democratic grandstanding and speeches for the most part. So it was a really bizarre kind of construction for this entire thing. I think that it seemed that she didn't really know the facts of the case that she was dealing with, that she asked questions that betrayed a lack of knowledge. And I also think that by the end, she kind of knew that she'd fucked up. And she asked Dr. Ford if, you know, she can acknowledge that this is a weird format. Dr. Ford was like, yeah. And I saw a lot of Republicans were pretty mad about it. I don't think that they were satisfied that she did their bidding for them.
Yeah, I think it was a very poorly conceived plan that was executed even more poorly. You're right. She seemed to have less knowledge of the facts than the average Twitter user who's been following this closely. And where she seemed to have the most knowledge and most interest was not about what happened to Dr. Ford and whether Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge did this, but to defend the Republicans on the process of when the hearing was going to be and when she was in contact with Dianne Feinstein. That she was much more interested in whether what reporter she talked to or when she sent a letter or who paid for her polygraph, none of which is relevant to what may or may not have happened. And that kind of gives away the game for what the Republicans were actually after.
That's what I took from it, too, is that the Republican case here is they don't want to say that Dr. Ford is a liar. So their case is she is a victim, as is Brett Kavanaugh, of a Democratic smear campaign. That is the line that they're going with, because therefore, then they don't have to say that she's a liar, but they can infer that and say that it's the Democrats' fault. And it seemed as though Rachel Mitchell's questions were trying to support that narrative by saying, who paid for the polygraph test? Well, Dr. Ford's lawyers paid for the polygraph test, as is standard, as both of the lawyers said during the hearing.
Right.
And then there was, you said you had a fear of flying, and yet here you are. And the fear of flying was supposed to delay the hearing. And so their big thing is they're making a case that the hearing was delayed and that that's just a Democratic strategy to delay, delay, delay. And so she was trying to prove that she was like, oh, well, you fly on vacations all the time. I mean, it was fucking absurd.
Yeah. And they were getting really hung up on process questions. Like they were shaking their fists, especially during the intermissions, because the only people we got to see question for directly was Mitchell. We didn't get to see the actual rage of the Republicans, although that would have been, you know what, I think I would have walked slowly into the sea if I would have had to watch that all morning. This was hard enough. But one of the things that that they were saying is just they're so mad about, you know, this wasn't the proper procedure, this is this and this. My main point about this is that if you found serious misbehavior among a nominee for the highest court in the land, it doesn't really matter how you found out that information. Like I was saying earlier, if someone walked by my apartment building and saw flames coming out of my bedroom window and broke in and saved my cat, and I walked by and I was like, wait, how'd you get my apartment building to put the cat back in there? You know,
who paid for your Uber over to the apartment building?
Did George Soros make you keys? Like that's ridiculous. I think that it's in America's best interest to be aware of all of the skeletons in the closets of people that are nominated to be Supreme Court justices, and to be angry about the process is egregious.
Yeah.
And it's also, Brett Kavanaugh does not have a right to be on the Supreme Court.
Right.
The standard of whether you get a lifetime appointment to the highest court in the land is not beyond a reasonable doubt. It is a job interview. And it is the Senate's responsibility to ensure that they put someone on the court who, beyond a shadow of a doubt, is not a person who would engage in these sorts of things, exceeds his right, Brett Kavanaugh's right, to be on the court. In the amount of entitlement that Republicans and Brett Kavanaugh himself have had about this role is disgusting, really.
Yeah. I mean, I go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, though, watching him kind of react with aggression to being questioned and being so emotionally volatile during his portion of the hearing sort of reminded me very much of like a, you know, an 80s teen bully. And our president is kind of in that model, too. Like it's a sort of overly emotional, reactive man who can't handle anything but getting exactly what he wants all the time. And that's what I was seeing today.
Who's that guy who plays all the teen bullies? Johnny Zepka or whatever from Karate Kid?
Sweep the leg, Johnny.
As I was watching it, I couldn't help but think over and over again, like, today never had to happen. They could have replaced him at any moment with an equally conservative right-wing judge and still achieved their goals. And if they didn't want to do that, they could have conducted a more intense FBI background investigation. They could have had Mark Judge testify. And you could see this sort of on the face of Rachel Mitchell, the prosecutor, at the very end, that moment you were just talking about, Aaron, when she's talking to Ford at the very end. And she's basically saying, like, as you know, this is not the process we usually use to talk to someone who makes a sexual assault allegation. We usually talk to someone in private. We do this, we do this. This is basically, she's saying, this is not the process I would have chosen, but here I am and here you are, because all of these fucking assholes couldn't give up the fact that they want Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court more than anyone else. Couldn't find anyone else besides Brett Kavanaugh to do that.
I mean, the whole thing is, you're exactly right. The whole thing is so wild because, look, let's be honest. I would love it if there was a world where Kavanaugh lost a vote and then Democrats took the Senate and we would one day get that Supreme Court seat. That is most likely not going to happen.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether Kavanaugh withdraws, whether he loses, Republicans have the ability, because they control the Senate, to put someone just as conservative, maybe more conservative in some ways, than Brett Kavanaugh on the court. So it's not about that. And what I think is so troubling is that this has become, to confirm Kavanaugh or not confirm Kavanaugh, it's become this Republican litmus test, which is really just sort of a test of the sort of like toxic masculinity about it, which is we have to jam him through because if not, we will show weakness. We must own the libs. We must show the women. You know, it's like
right.
Jack Posobiec, whatever that guy's name is, tweeted today. Today's the end of feminism. There is something that is very, when this is all said and done, there is something that is going to have really long-lasting effects, and I think a very negative way on how people view discussions of gender in society, about sexual assault, because it's polarizing it around where, and this is what happens when you have someone like Trump as president, is to believe the victims is somehow to have a slight on the president. So Republicans have to take the other side, whether it's Brett Kavanaugh, Roy Moore, Rob Porter, Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, whoever else is, that you have to side with the man. And that it's somehow, those are your Republican bona fides in this day and age. And that's going to matter for a very long time, whether Brett Kavanaugh's on the court or not.
And first of all, feminism is not dead. If anything, this is a lot of people's superhero origin story. In 1992, more women ran for office after the Anita Hill hearings. More women ran for office than ever before. After Donald Trump was elected president, so many women ran for office or started running for office through Emily's List and other vote drafting or organizations like that, that it was massive. It was massive. And women are doing a lot of the work on the ground. Women are doing a lot of organizing. Every single time we do a live show, there are so many women there. Women are fired the fuck up. And I think seeing this, just as one woman watching this, I am going to kind of have that feeling in my belly for weeks now. Like, yeah. If Kavanaugh gets confirmed, will Roe be overturned? Probably. There are 13 cases right now, one step away from the Supreme Court, that could chip away at Roe. But that doesn't mean that women are going to stop fighting. Feminism is women standing up for themselves and continuing to fight. And if Jack Probiotic or whatever his fucking name is believes that women are that easy to put down, like, we've been giving birth without anesthesia for thousands of years. We can withstand one more day of this. We can withstand one more year of this, and because we're going to, and we always have. And like, I don't want to be like Pollyanna, because I don't think Pollyanna said fuck as much as I do. But I can't be discouraged by this. Like, it sucked. Today sucked, but I can't feel discouraged by this, because the only option is to try to find ways to pick out the good from this. And I think that there's kernels of it.
So after Dr. Ford finished testifying, and actually during her testimony too, a lot of, not the super crazy Republicans, but a lot of, like, you know, the never Trump Republicans who've been saying over the last couple weeks, like, oh, even though we don't like Trump, this whole, you know, this smear job against Kavanaugh, this is really rallying all the Republicans back to the party and blah, blah, blah. A lot of them were saying, oh no, she's very credible. I think the nomination's dead. This is bad. Fox, Chris Wallace was saying this is a disaster for the Republicans. So all the immediate reaction after Dr. Ford finished testifying was this was a disaster for the Republicans. And I kind of thought to myself at that moment, all right, everyone hold this in their minds right now, because everything in our society for the last however many years now has been like, you know, it goes down the memory hole in 10 minutes because everything goes so fast and we have like collective amnesia as a country. And then sure enough, Brett Kavanaugh steps up to testify and just starts yelling, angry, outraged, crying. I mean, what is everyone's first reactions about the Kavanaugh 45-minute opening statement that he delivered?
We're exchanging like, well, are you going to go first? Why don't you go first? Sure.
I wanted to know why he was yelling at me. I mean, yeah. It was everything that you would tell him not to do in a normal world, right? Where you want to show, even if while you are arguing for your own innocence, you want to show some empathy for Dr. Ford, to which he showed none. You want to show some respect for the process, that these are legitimate questions that you should answer if you're going to be given the privilege to be on the Supreme Court. He showed none. He seemed angry and entitled, which is the exact thing you shouldn't do unless you have an audience of one, and that is the angry, entitled man in chief.
Yeah.
I thought the punditry whiplash kind of betrayed a pervasive double standard that men and women face in their behavior. If the roles were reversed and the temperaments were reversed, if Kavanaugh had gone first and been just kind of emotional but steadfast throughout his testimony, and then what if Dr. Ford got up there and started yelling? No, not, and Dr. Ford is a white woman. If Dr. Ford were any race but white,
right,
she would have been completely turned into a political cartoon by Fox News within minutes. She would have been a meme that Don Jr. was sharing on his Instagram within minutes. I think what's important about it is an audience of one on one hand, but on the other hand, it's an audience of like four. And two of those four are women, Collins and Murkowski. Now, yeah. As a woman, I can't speak for every woman, but I can say that when a man yells at me, I don't really take kindly to that. I'm not really one who responds well to feeling like an emotional and unstable man is screaming, especially if I'm trying to decide whether or not that emotional and unstable man deserves to have a lifetime appointment to a high court. So yeah. I think that his yelling, my reaction was like, Jesus Christ, dude. Like, I realize you've been through a hard time and I feel deeply for his wife and his children. What they're going through is horrible and totally not their fault. But his emotional outburst to me betrayed his unfitness for the court even more than his judicial record did.
Yeah. What about temperament? What about, a quality that you need to be a judge at all? That was right out the window. Also, it sort of betrayed him as a partisan hack, too. I mean, he went after Democrats. I'm watching this unfold and he's yelling about the Democratic hit job and the left. He said that he floated a conspiracy that this whole thing is revenge against him for what he did to the Clintons.
Yeah, I mean, nobody on the left is that defensive of the Clintons.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's fine. We're not worried about it.
No, we're
don't,
good.
Don't worry. And I just thought to myself, like, this is supposed to be a nonpartisan, objective judge. I'm terrified of him on the court. I never wanted him on the court in the first place. I didn't like it. But, like, he was the fact that he was so nakedly partisan and angry to me was just like, and look, I don't think it, and some people say, well, you'd be really angry too if you were falsely accused. Okay, well, Brett Kavanaugh has been accused now for a while now.
Yeah.
All right? And he was on Fox News and sat for a very long interview just a couple days ago. And he sat there and just mumbled talking points, the same talking points over and over again. If he was falsely accused then, he didn't show even a hint of emotion. And then just as a coincidence between then and today, we see all these reports that, oh, Trump is upset that he didn't show anger. Trump is upset that he wasn't fighting for himself. Republicans want him to fight harder. And so then he comes in today and sits down and just fucking uncorks.
Mm-hmm.
So like, do we really, I thought he was more playing an angry guy than actually being angry.
Yeah, I used to work on a comedy clip show where we had people kind of in a room reacting to clips. It was like a best week. It was called Best Week Ever.
Yeah.
And sometimes you'd be in the room. I was a writer, and I'd be in the room with people that were just not having a good day, and you would just see the actor get more and more unraveled. And that watching Brett Kavanaugh today kind of reminded me of being in the studio with someone who just wasn't keeping it together and was just getting more and more just, and it's like, can you give it to me with more energy? And then they give you the line and it's like, ooh, that does not sound like a way a human would talk
yeah.
about anything. It just seemed like he was performing outrage, but also that some of his outrage was channeled from his feeling sorry for himself.
And entitled.
Right.
It was like an entitled anger.
Yeah, completely. And it's a specific look. It's like an 80s teen bully face that he has. Like, he pushed himself back from his chair, especially when Senator Klobuchar was talking to him. When he reciprocally asked her if she'd ever blacked out from drinking. Like, she's the one being confirmed to the Senate right now.
He kept popping off like that in a really, that was so rude.
I wanted to send him to the principal's office. Like, that's just, it was extremely rude and uncalled for. And, you know, it sucks if he believes himself to be falsely, or if he's playing somebody who's been falsely accused, then of course he's going to be angry. But to be like, now, have you? Like, sassily, it was not a good look.
Well, that was to the point about his inability to cope with the kind of kid he was or the kind of things he's done in his life. That was when he got the most angry. When they asked him these very specific questions about drinking too much in high school and the things he did. And the obvious thing that a lot of people would say who did things they weren't proud of in high school would be, I'd made some mistakes and I've changed, but he refuses to say that. He originally tried to argue when Senator Whitehouse asked him about being the Ralphing at Beach Week, that had something to do with a weak stomach as opposed to drinking a lot of beer. I mean,
catchable lies.
Every time he opens his mouth, he further undermines his credibility. And if we were living in an irrational world where you were making a judgment where he really does have to prove to everyone in the Senate, the people who matter, who are going to decide whether he gets a job in the Supreme Court, decide that we definitely believe him over Dr. Ford. That is what the choice is, because this is a job interview. If you were interviewing someone to work at a company or in an office, and you were faced with allegations like these, credible allegations, if you heard from someone, someone like Dr. Ford called you and said, this applicant who wants this job at your company did this, and they've said this to you and used their name publicly, you would not hire that person. This is not the standard of whether Brett Kavanaugh goes to jail or not. His life is not ruined. If he does not get this Supreme Court seat, you know what he does? He goes back to his lifetime appointment on the second highest court in the land. Like, cry me a river.
With Merrick Garland.
With Merrick Garland.
Yeah.
And look, you know, he got emotional when he was talking about his daughter and his family. And I don't doubt that emotion was real. Like, I'm sure he's very upset what his family has had to go through. I think he's also not quite reckoning with the fact that what his responsibility was in putting his family through some of this. But it's like, I don't doubt the fact that he was upset about what his daughters had to go through, or that it was a real emotion when he was talking about his dad. Again, I just think that he has not come to terms with this thing that he has done, or at least his general behavior, even like you said, Dan, even his general behavior when he was in high school, where clearly we know from accounts from Mark Judge, from what he wrote in a yearbook and everybody else, that he drank a lot. From his freshman year roommate in college, who said he was incoherently and belligerently drunk all the time.
If the view of the right is, or two things, one, that Dr. Ford is part of a left-wing conspiracy to derail Kavanaugh's confirmation, and that Judge Kavanaugh deeply believes in his innocence. There are a couple of things that people have to reckon with. One, John, as you said, she originally raised these concerns before he was nominated.
Right.
In the hopes that Trump would nominate someone else. Second, if Kavanaugh and the Republicans truly believed beyond a shadow of a doubt in his innocence, then they would do two things. They would have asked for an FBI investigation, which may not be conclusive, but you could possibly learn a lot more. And two, they would have had Mark Judge testify under oath as the other person who is alleged to have been in the room. Those are the two. That is what you would do if you want to clear your name and show everyone that you were innocent. Those are things you would do. And they refuse to do those two things, which raises a lot of questions.
And not only do they refuse to do those two things, but when questioned today repeatedly, Brett Kavanaugh refused to allow those things to happen. In fact, so far, who knows what his moments have been like since we've been recording, but so far in the trial, his worst moments were when Senator Durbin continually questioned him, okay, why wouldn't you have an FBI investigation? Open up the FBI investigation again. Bring Mark Judge in to testify. And he dissembled. He, you know, tried to change the topic, and he went over and over again.
Yeah, Dick Durbin had a really good day. We're on a big group text for hysteria, and I texted "Big Dick Energy" to the whole, and then that got a good reaction, so I tweeted it. But it was
that's exactly how we operate the Positive America text chain.
Just doing a little workshopping of that. One really telling kind of contrast between two of the two testimonies was. When Dr. Ford testified and she was discussing her female friend who was at the party with her, she mentioned that her friend is now facing health problems and is taking care of herself. And she did it in this really empathetic way that was like, I'm glad that she's spending time focusing on her health, blah, 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 blah. When Kavanaugh was testifying and they brought up Mark Judge, he immediately did this weird thing that people who are trying to deflect the conversation do, which is where they take the most sympathetic thing about the person and accuse you of exploiting that or attacking them because of it. So the Mark Judge thing was like, you're going to attack somebody with an addiction. You're going to attack somebody with a disease. And all they were doing was questioning him about a book that Mark Judge wrote about his time partying with some guy named Bart O'Kavanaugh that was definitely not Brett Kavanaugh.
Right.
And it's just that to me is a tell of somebody who is defensive and lying. It was so naked to me. And the contrast between him and Dr. Ford was really stark.
And again, I mean, talk about like what new information, what new facts do we learn from the hearing? Dr. Ford testified that she saw Mark Judge again 6 to 8 weeks after the incident. She saw him in a Safeway because he was working at a Safeway, and that his face went white when he saw her, and he didn't really want to look at her, and he didn't really want to talk to her. And then, sure enough, someone from the Washington Post was able to corroborate that Mark, and she was like, well, I don't know when he actually worked at that job. But if I knew when he worked at that Safeway, I would be able to tell you when that happened for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, in his book, someone from the Washington Post found that he worked at that Safeway in the summer of 1982 when this incident is alleged to have happened.
Yeah, this is like a really dark retelling of summer of 69. It's
I know.
Wow, summer of 82. God, it was awful. Yeah, that was something that I thought was really funny about when the Republicans just gave up on leaning on their Aunt Lydia to question Dr. Ford, and they just started questioning Judge Kavanaugh themselves, I thought it was really interesting is that they would all kind of realize that they were kind of getting toward, maybe we should have an FBI investigation, and then
right.
They would back off of it. There were a few instances where I was like, oh, they're asking for more information. You know how to get more information? It would be to investigate. And Brett Kavanaugh was super defensive about the FBI's role and what the FBI does. But I thought that the Republicans kept backing themselves into a corner. Whether that matters or not really comes down to a handful of people that aren't in this room right now. But I thought it was a telling moment.
And the fucking calendar, too. We talk about him going through the calendar, and he's like, First of all, we never drank on weeknights. We didn't drink on weeknights because we all worked during the summer, so we didn't drink on weeknights. On the calendar, it has one night in early July where he said with Mark Judge and PJ and someone else at Timmy's house for, quote, skis, which meant brewskis.
it was a weeknight. I don't know why you're assuming that, John.
No, well, he basically said
maybe they were watching an alpine competition. You don't know.
So he was the captain of the ski team.
It's like his own calendar refutes his contention that he didn't drink on the weeknights. I mean, it's just easily catchable lies.
I think that another important point that I think got glossed over is the Republicans keep saying, and Kavanaugh said over and over again, that statements from the other people
right.
who were at the party that Christine Ford discusses have refuted her account. And that is not true. That is absolutely not true. They say they do not remember such a party. And as Christine Ford said in her testimony, they probably don't because it was like any other party except for her because she was assaulted. And I'm not as old as Brett Kavanaugh. And if you were to ask me about a specific party in high school that was just like any other party, I wouldn't remember that party.
Yeah.
And so when they go around saying that her account has been refuted, that is a lie. It is an absolute lie. And I think that is getting glossed over in the media coverage and how it's being discussed in the hearing.
So let's talk about the reaction after Kavanaugh or during the Kavanaugh portion of the hearings, which we're still in. A lot of Republicans suddenly changed their minds and are now saying, oh, he's very credible. You know, now we're standing with Brett. The White House, you know, there's reporting from the White House, people with White House sources saying Trump loves this. Trump said, this is why I picked the guy. White House people are saying, we love it. Don Jr., asshole's been tweeting how great Kavanaugh's being. So, and then there's other people who said, by the way, Kavanaugh being this outraged and angry will play well with a lot of the Republican base, which is a take I, you know, knew was coming and we're going to have to contend with and could be correct, right? I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of angry white men out there who said, yeah, that's my guy.
Yeah. I mean, there was a poll that came out this week from Marist and PBS NewsHour and NPR that found that more than 60% of men who are Republicans believe that Dr. Ford is lying. Yeah. And so I think that, yeah. And also I've seen the line, you know, publicly men discussing it from the right, saying like, this could happen to you. This could happen to your son. This could happen to your neighbor. And by this could happen, they mean a woman could say that they assaulted them,
right?
Which is patently false. We have a very recent historical example of a man, a male man, a non-female person, being nominated to be a Supreme Court justice and flying through with some Democratic votes, with no sexual assault allegations. That's because Neil Gorsuch apparently didn't sexually assault anybody.
Is that Georgetown Prep alumni, Neil Gorsuch?
That yeah. is. Went to the same high school. Was not over at the house for skis that night, though.
And guess what? Trump was still president then, and we were angrier about that Supreme Court seat because that was the stolen Supreme Court seat that Merrick Garland should have had. So if anyone was going to whip up some false allegation of sexual assault, Neil Gorsuch would have been a much more likely target for Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, and this is a wild theory here, but maybe women just don't go around making shit up when it comes to sexual assault. Maybe this is something that is very serious and that women have seen countless examples of women who have publicly said that their survivors be just raked through the coals. Maybe it's not something that anybody would lie about because the stakes are too high.
Right, when you have to sit during testimony in front of the entire world live on national television and testify about this under penalty of perjury. Yeah, maybe that's not something that you just go do. I mean, again, I just keep coming back to It is correct that we may never know exactly what happened that night in 1982, but Dr. Blasey Ford has absolutely no incentive to lie about this, and Brett Kavanaugh has every single incentive to lie about what happened. That is what we know, and we also know that he has been caught in many, many small and big lies throughout this entire process, and she has been nothing but credible.
I agree. And I also think that before I'd really seen Judge Kavanaugh speak publicly, all I knew was some of his judicial history because of the case with the undocumented teenager. Mm-hmm. But I'd never seen him in public. I'd never seen him speak. And the more I am exposed to the sort of person he seems to be and the sort of person he collapses into when he's subjected to any form of pressure at all, the more I think, you know, even if he's not guilty of sexual assault, this is not a person that I would want on the Supreme Court. I don't want him besmirching the sacred bench that my goddess Ruth Bader Ginsburg sits on and my goddess Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. I don't want him. He doesn't deserve the same job that those women have. He just doesn't. He doesn't have the temperament. And if a woman acted like that, she would not even be under consideration.
I wouldn't fucking hire him for anything. What job are you? I don't want to work with that guy.
Yeah, he seems like a dick.
Man, he's just like yelling and screaming all the time.
I mean, that goes to the difference in how men and women can respond in situations like this. Because if you're Brett Kavanaugh and you believe you're innocent, you are rightfully angry at the Democratic senators for saying you're guilty. But Christine Blasey Ford has just as much right to be angry at these Republicans who have accused her of being a liar, and not just a liar, basically a partisan con woman,
right?
Who would go before the nation, make up a story about this incredibly traumatic thing to derail a confirmation, and every right to be angry, and no ability to be angry because of that. Just imagine how the world would have seen. And then the idea that, you know, to your point about how the Republicans responded to Kavanaugh's response and that Trump is happy about it, which is clear because the higher up you go on the asshole index, mm-hmm. the more Trump likes you.
Right. That is very true. So what do we think happens now? It does seem like we've come full circle and we're right back to where we were politically at the beginning of this hearing, which is many Republicans, if not most Republicans, if not all Republicans in the Senate, we don't know, are behind Kavanaugh. Lindsey Graham screamed at the end of his temper tantrum when he totally lost it that I will vote for you. And not only will Lindsey Graham vote for him, but Lindsey Graham basically then threatened his colleagues and said, if anyone votes against this guy, you are, you know, saying that you like this kind of destructive politics and it's the worst thing I've ever seen in politics, blah, blah, blah. So we have a lot of Republicans and Trump in the White House rallying behind Kavanaugh. We have the Democrats very much against the nomination. And I guess, are we down to Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Jeff Flake, perhaps? Anyone else?
Well, first of all, if I were a senator and Lindsey Graham was like, vote against your conscience and everything decent in you, otherwise I'm going to come after you, I'd be like, I'll take my chances. I think I can. I'm pretty sure that most of the women in the Senate can take Lindsey Graham. Especially Mazie Hirono has been a real hero during Amazing. This whole process. And I'm pretty sure she could take Lindsey Graham in a fight, if not just through her cunning. But I think that, you know, like I was saying before, I think that we need to be realistic about what's going to happen with the court. And Dan, you touched on this earlier. Like, if it's not Kavanaugh, it's going to be somebody else who's going to be committed to conservative judicial principles like overturning Roe. And I think that what needs to happen now is that between now and Election Day, everybody who listens to this needs to make sure that they're registered to vote and that everybody that they know and care about is registered to vote. And they need to make sure that they're engaged on a local level because, you know, we've neglected the local level for a while. I think that we need to just, let's assume the worst. Let's assume the worst, but keep the faith. And try to carry on as best we can until we get through November.
What do you think, Dan?
I mean, you're right. We're right back to where we started in the sense that a handful of people will decide whether Brett Kavanaugh sits on the court. Yeah. And none of them are in this room, which is probably a mistake. But I do think that having heard Dr. Ford on national television, which I imagine when the ratings come out about how many people watch this on cable and streaming or whatever else, it's going to be pretty huge. I think this will be a moment people will remember for a long time. And I think whatever else happens with the Kavanaugh vote, the politics around this and what this moment means or altered is whether if they had just jammed this vote through without ever having heard her speak.
Yeah. And I think as far as the outcome sort of leads, no matter what outcome there is, it leads to what Aaron said, which is if this nomination falls because two Republicans vote against him, I do think it's true that the Republican base will be angrier, possibly more energized to vote in November, and that's going to require us to work even harder. And if this nomination goes through and he gets on the court, then we're going to have to keep working, keep fighting, keep registering people to vote, and just fucking eliminate this party electorally in November as best we can. So either way, we're going to be in a big fight here because, you know, and it's either it goes through because Susan Collins and Murkowski and Flake just say, you know, we found her credible, but at the same time, we don't want to prosecute this innocent man mm-hmm. and ruin his life for this. And so
we want to have this cake, but on the other hand, we want to eat it too.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's or they stand up and say, you know, no, I found her credible, and we can. I mean, I don't understand why this is a politically dangerous thing for Collins, Murkowski, or Flake, especially Flake, who's fucking retiring, to say, like, I'm a good conservative. I want a good conservative judge on this court. We should nominate Amy Barrett tomorrow. Or Thomas Hardiman tomorrow and get this person through by November. And so we still have our political goal of getting conservative justice on. And we might never know what exactly happened there, but she came forward and was incredibly credible today and powerful. And so I have to vote against this nomination. What's the downside of that politically?
That's true. I mean,
being voted off the island.
Yeah. I mean, not being invited to lunch with Lindsey Graham, he seems like so pleasant. I think that, you know, if my rights are going to be taken away, I would prefer they were taken away by somebody who doesn't have a history of sexual assault allegations.
Yeah.
The dumbest discussion on Twitter, which is saying a lot, but is about what the politics of this, right, is does this mean that it's going to excite women to vote more? Does this mean it's going to excite the Trump base who wasn't paying attention to the midterms? No one knows.
No one knows.
We have no idea. And it's particularly none of the people talking about it. No. because usually it's based on, well, I got this tweet from this Never Trumper Republican with three followers and a Russian surname who said that now they were going to vote for, I don't know, what, the guy running against Heidi Heitkamp or whatever.
Yeah.
And like, those are dumb discussions. We all decide whether the politics are good or bad. We decide whether Democrats will come out better, no matter what happens here, or Republicans come out better, by, as Aaron said, by voting. The other Lindsey Graham thing I noticed, as I was watching him, I recently watched the HBO movie about Anita Hill. And I was watching that thinking, one day there will be a movie about this. And Lindsey Graham is going to come off as a gigantic asshole.
I eagerly await that day. I think that'd be funny.
Not just in that movie, I thought this is how Lindsey Graham is going to be remembered. This is like his, I mean, that outburst that he had right before we came in here was like nothing I had seen.
Oh.
And he is, I mean, a lot of people are speculating, like, is he auditioning to be the next attorney general? Is he auditioning to be the next secretary of defense? I hope whatever job Lindsey Graham is excited about is worth what he has done to his legacy and his integrity and his name over these last couple of weeks with this nomination.
Lindsey Graham is one of the great weather vanes in American politics. When Barack Obama first got elected in 2000, we got in office in 2009, Lindsey Graham was in and out of the West Wing 6 times a week because he was going to work with us on closing Gitmo, passing comprehensive immigration reform, climate change. He was going to be the lead sponsor of a cap and trade bill.
That's hard to
imagine. And as soon as he saw Republicans starting to go down in primaries because of the Tea Party, he went far to the right. And what he is looking at right now is, I believe he's up in 2020. He just watched his close friend, Mark Sanford, Republican congressman, lose a primary because Trump got mad at him. So he's going to crawl as far into Trump's lap as he possibly can to win that primary. He is a person who loves being on Sunday shows and being in office. And the politics and the principle are sort of irrelevant to that.
Yeah, he's a great example. And this is another thing we talked about in Hysteria this week. Plug. He's a great example of like what happens when nerds get power. Like, they just will not relinquish it. They just hold on white knuckled. And the fact that he was working with Obama or trying to work with Obama on bipartisan climate bills and is now screaming about how, in a way, Dr. Ford is as much a victim as Brett Kavanaugh here, which he said twice today, once in an intermission in Ford's testimony, and I guess it got the reaction that he wanted, so he said it when he was questioning Kavanaugh. I think that the fact that he went from that to the screaming man is a testament to his kind of Eddie Haskellness. He's just kind of a person that'll go where the power is, and he's exactly the sort of person that shouldn't be in Washington.
He also threatened Democrats. He said, if this is the new norm, you better watch out for your nominees.
Ugh.
Which I guess is like, we'll be leveling false allegations of sexual assault against you if he believes that these are false, which he clearly does. And he also said that I feel ambushed. Lindsey Graham is the victim today.
Phrasing. Earlier this week, McConnell used the phrase plow through. They're going to plow through this. And Brett Kavanaugh was talking about it. He's just never going to give up. You guys tried really hard to stop me, but I'm never going to. It's like, guys, think about the context of what you're talking about right now. And I know it's not funny, but it kind of is because I need to find something to laugh at right now. They are so like Tobias Funke bad at picking appropriate words and discussing sexual assault.
On that note, yes, so everyone, no matter what, votesaveamerica.com, go register, go get your friends registered. I mean, we've been saying this every day on every single issue and every incident since Trump won. The only way we're going to solve this is at the ballot box. So everyone go do that. And when we come back, we will have my interview with Katie Couric. On the pod today, we have our friend of the pod, who was on last year, one of our best guests on Pod Save America, Katie Couric. Katie, welcome back to the pod.
Hi, John. Thank you so much. And, you know, last time you had me on, someone, I think one of you called me a badass, and I had somebody from a card company actually make me badass cards. I have a bunch of cards that say Katie Couric, and under it, it says badass. So thank you so much for that, because I have some beautiful new calling cards, which I don't use often enough.
You are welcome. And also, it is a very apt title. You are a badass. So that's...
well, thank you.
I'm glad someone made cards for that.
thank you very much.
So we wanted to talk to you because you're launching this month a two-part documentary about the interviews you did with Sarah Palin during the 2008 presidential election. It's called The Palin Interviews 10 Years Later. Why did you think this was a good moment to go back and explore the conversations you had with Palin a decade ago? Obviously, anniversaries are a good time for that. But
right.
What was your thinking in producing this podcast?
Well, you know, they were pretty impactful interviews, certainly for me professionally. I think in terms of political interviews, I think many people remember them. John's cab drivers still say to me, thank you for that Sarah Palin interview, or they'll start talking about it and I'll say you're welcome, depending on their point of view. But, you know, I think it was such an important moment during the course of that campaign. And Brian Goldsmith, who was my political producer at CBS News at the time and is now my podcast partner in crime, we started thinking about it and saying, gosh, that was a decade ago. How did she set the scene for Donald Trump? What was it like behind the scenes? And so we interviewed all the key players. Obviously, we asked Governor Palin if she was interested in participating. She wasn't. But we talked to Steve Schmidt. We talked to Nicole Wallace. We talked to Frank Luntz, who was at the RNC when she gave that incredible speech accepting her party's nomination. I don't know if you remember, John, how, I mean, she was on fire that night. And I think it did give the Obama team a little bit of pause. David Axelrod says it didn't, and that as usual, per usual, then Senator Obama was sort of like, let's see how she does in a month, because this is a lot of hard work. It's taken me 6 months to get up to speed. But we talked to David Axelrod about it, and Mike Murphy and Michael Steele. And so this is kind of like game change on steroids. We're really taking listeners behind the scenes and what was going on in my head and the heads of everybody at CBS Evening News when we were getting ready to do it and after we had finished them.
So Axelrod was definitely right about what Obama said in response. I remember him saying, let's see what happens in a month after that speech. I don't know. Maybe Axe wasn't that worried about the speech. I was worried when she gave that speech at the convention. I remember
so
feeling...
tell me, I should have interviewed you because, you know, David was like, ho-hum, la-di-da. But when you saw her, I mean, it must have made you feel slightly trepidatious about what impact she was going to have on the campaign.
Yeah, because, look, I remember when she was announced and I thought, you know, who was this person? And, you know, I was very confused about, you know, why she was selected. And so I didn't quite get it. And then I remember seeing that speech at the convention. And, I mean, it's funny. Today we'd call it trolling. We didn't really call it trolling back then, but she had so many lines in that convention speech that were sort of just designed to perfectly needle Barack Obama and the Democratic Party in general. But
when she said she was mayor of Wasilla, which was kind of like a community organizer, and then everybody sort of booed, and then she said, but with real responsibilities.
Right, right.
Remember?
And I just thought it was a speech that could work, you know, and she was also, she was sunny in disposition when she gave that speech too. And
right.
So she could, she delivered a lot of really tough hits on Obama, but she did it with a smile and she sort of like looked like she was enjoying herself, you know, which I think.
And
is,
I don't think we'd ever quite seen anything like her, you
yeah.
know, in terms of her, you know, her style, her appearance, her relatability with a lot of American women at that moment in time, you know, having a son that was serving in Iraq. I mean, everything seemed to kind of touch on these sort of intangible qualities that could be quite appealing to a lot of the electorate, right?
Right. Oh, for sure. And so I sort of had that concern. Basically, because then she had a lot of those rallies, which were very successful, and a lot of people turned out, and suddenly McCain was getting all these huge crowds. And I had the concern basically until, and I can remember exactly where I was in the campaign headquarters in Chicago watching your interview with her. And then, you know, that's when most of us said, oh, I guess Obama was right.
So, well, What did you think? I'm curious, because when you watched those interviews, what struck you about them?
I was struck by the fact that she was just, I'd never seen someone running for such a high office, or really any office, seem so unprepared just on the basics of almost anything. And so, like, we were so shocked in the headquarters that you could hear the gasps from all of us as we watched this. It wasn't even like anyone was like cheering or happy yet. We were shocked that she couldn't answer a lot of these basic questions. I guess my question for you is, how did you prepare for those conversations? Like, when you were going into those interviews, did you have a certain goal in mind? Like, what made you think that you wanted to get at and ask questions that got to sort of her basic preparedness for the office, her basic knowledge about politics and news and current events?
I think both Brian and I, and we really worked for like 3 or 4 days on these questions and read everything. And I mean, we really, really tried to come up with questions that would be illuminating for the electorate, that would indicate her ability to be a critical thinker, her knowledge of public policy, and really her accumulated knowledge through the years of sort of the arc of history, if you will, mm-hmm. and kind of understanding some really important issues. We interviewed her after she had visited a number of leaders at the UN, world leaders. And, you know, it just felt like she just was trying so hard to pronounce Ahmadinejad correctly, you know,
right.
And that she had talked to all these leaders. But the financial crisis was sort of front and center. So obviously we had to ask her a lot of questions about the economy and all kinds of things. And, you know, I think she was just very simply out of her depth. Now, I also believe her way of speaking, her kind of unusual kind of cadence and mm-hmm. the way she expressed herself, I think it made it even worse in a way. But because she just had a certain jargon that felt different and strange, I think, to the people watching or listening to her. But I think we wanted to cover everything from soup to nuts, if we could. The first was focused on foreign policy and the economy because of news events, and the second was really focused on domestic policy. And we just crafted our questions that would really – I mean, I think President Obama would have talked for 4 hours, right, if we had asked him the same questions and sort of had an intellectual deliberation as he was answering those questions. But for her, I think it was the concepts and were really difficult to grasp. And, you know, honestly, in fairness, as President Obama told David Axelrod, even the most intelligent person who's familiar with public policy, it takes a long time to get up to speed on so many of these issues. I mean, I couldn't have answered many of those questions really intelligently and fluently. I mean, I didn't have the background on every one of those issues. But I think it just underscored how ill-prepared she was. And during our podcast, Nicole Wallace talked about the fact that, you know, she hadn't kept up with public policy. She just wasn't interested in public policy. And therein, you know, was the problem.
What do you remember about your mindset from the interview itself? Were there moments during the conversation where you remember getting thrown off guard at all by where the conversation ended up going? Did you sort of change plans in the middle of the interview based on anything that she said?
Not really. You know, you asked me how I prepared, and I did call a number of people on both sides of the aisle because I was curious, like, what did they want to know? What did they think was important for viewers to hear? You know, so I would talk to Richard Haass about foreign policy and about Iran. I talked to Sam Nunn just because I'm a big fan of Sam Nunn's about biological weapons, because that's an area of expertise for him. I talked to Madeleine Albright and a number of others. And I think it was Madeleine Albright who gave me the best piece of advice. She said, just let her talk. So I resisted the temptation to rescue her. Mm. And, you know, when you're doing an interview, especially, I think, on television for some reason, you especially live television. So this was taped, so it wasn't as bad. But there's this impulse to jump in if there's dead air and to fill it. But I basically I resisted that temptation and just let her talk. And as a result, the more she talked, the more I think it became apparent that, you know, she just wasn't that well-versed on a number of these issues. So yeah. I thought that was super helpful. And similarly, I also tried, I don't know if you remember, John, I'm sure you do, how Charlie Gibson was criticized for putting his glasses at the end of his nose. And, you realize on television, it's such a visual medium that body language, facial expressions, sometimes, you know, it's a Rorschach test for a lot of people, and they can project their own anger feelings onto you. So it was really important for me to be completely without expression.
Yeah.
So I didn't look at her askance. I didn't look at her critically. I kept a very almost Parkinsonian affect mm-hmm. on my face so that I knew that her supporters would blame me if she had a poor performance. And I didn't want that to happen. And actually, after the interview was over, there were very, very few Republicans. It started to bubble up as she said that I asked her gotcha questions. But very few Republicans were critical of my questions or the way I conducted that interview or those interviews.
Yeah, I remember that, is that you didn't you didn't interject really at all. You did, you really did sort of give her the space to really do the damage, which is like, yeah. I guess what you said was sort of your strategy. I was struck by the fact that it wasn't like you were quizzing her about obscure foreign policy matters. You know, I mean, one of the questions that really got her was, what do you read?
Right. That's the one that everyone remembers because it played on a loop on cable news.
Right.
And I always found that kind of perplexing because there were so many policy questions in there. And I still don't quite, maybe you can help me understand why that so captured the public imagination and got so much attention.
I think it's because there's a lot of Americans who could identify with someone, even though that person is running for vice president, not knowing a specific policy answer to, whether it's a foreign policy topic or domestic policy topic, because, most people are casual news observers and they pay attention to policy somewhat, but they're not, they don't know details exactly. But mm-hmm. most people do think if you ask them, oh, what do you read? They'd come up with, an answer fairly quickly, or at least not sort of dissemble like she did. Like you said, it wasn't just that her answers didn't make her seem prepared. It's that partly because of her style of conversation, she just sort of, and the fact that you didn't sort of interrupt or save her, meaning that she just had all this space to just kind of, garble a lot of words.
Well, I kept asking her for specifics. She
right.
said anything they put in front of me. And when I asked her for specifics, I still, for the life of me, don't understand why she just didn't come up with something, especially because we saw her reading the New York Times on her campaign plane that morning.
Right.
Maybe she didn't want to say she read the New York Times. Maybe she thought that would get her in trouble with the base. And she could have said, I really asked her what she read on a regular basis that helped shape her worldview before
right.
she was tapped. And I actually asked that question because, I found her ideology to be so, specific. And she seemed to be, very conservative in her views of the world. And I just wanted to know, she could have said, the Bible helped shape my political mm-hmm. views. She could have said, William F. Buckley. I don't know. Or she could have said, Katie, it's really from being in Alaska and reading every Alaska newspaper every day because these are my constituents and this is what I've learned. Anything.
Yeah.
She could not seem to sort of finesse her way out of that question. And I think what it indicated to some people was that she had this significant lack of intellectual curiosity. And I think that's probably what was so off-putting that she, not only that, but then she couldn't sort of think on her feet
right.
and come up with something, you know, that would answer that question. But she was really annoyed with me at that point. I think she just wanted me out of her line of vision at that point. And she said, you know, she said, people in Alaska read. And I wanted to say, I know that, Governor. I'm not suggesting that.
Right.
I just wanted to know what shaped your views and helped inform the person you are today and the way you see things.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that was so befuddling. If I ever run into her, which I probably won't, and we actually maybe had a few glasses of wine, I'd like to ask her why she answered that way.
Yeah, I would love to know that. So a lot of people have said, and I believe this as well, that Palin, her candidacy sort of paved the way for a Donald Trump. I can't help but think that if, you know, Donald Trump has given so many interviews where it is clear he doesn't know what he's talking about, that he's not really prepared, that he doesn't have any kind of grasp on policy, domestic or foreign. And yet, even though he's given these interviews, the impact hasn't been what it was when you conducted these interviews with Palin back then. Why do you think that is? Do you think that the media has changed? Do you think the American public has changed? Has politics changed since then?
I think there's a whole host of reasons. You know, I think that the anti-intellectual sentiment, you know, the death of expertise and what we've seen in Brexit and all around the world, people mistrusting, you know, the elite, academics, et cetera, wasn't at such a fevered pitch back then, 10 years ago. I think it was starting to bubble up. So I think that's one reason that people feel that maybe that makes them feel like the president is closer to them in terms of how he sees the world. He's not a snob. He's not this overeducated Ivy League elitist. I think maybe there's partially that. You know, I think if a female did that, even today, I think she would be judged much more harshly because I do think, and I'd like to hear your views on this, that women are still held to different standards. There was a study done by a number of California political scientists that said coverage of Ferraro and Palin that was more negative. They had more questions about so-called work-life balance. There was a preoccupation with their appearance. And so you wonder if that might come into play even now, certainly, if it were a woman making these mistakes or showing this lack of knowledge or even making these outrageous statements that seem to be so readily forgiven by Donald Trump's hardcore supporters. So, and I think the media landscape has changed. I think, sadly, President Trump has been very effective with this mantra of fake news. And, you know, I try not to even use that term because it's so offensive to me in terms of how he tars everyone with this brush and this moniker. And I think it has permeated into the culture in a way. So I think that if I were doing this interview today, it would be easy for Donald Trump supporters to dismiss it as fake news, or it was edited and it wasn't fair. And if they ever saw it,
yeah.
Because people are watching only the outlets that reflect their own views back at them. As my friend Nicole Seligman says, they're looking for affirmation, not information. So you can wall yourself off from so much news these days that, you know, I think it could be just dismissed out of hand if people ever watched it in the first place. So yeah. I think all these factors kind of come to bear on when you think about how things have changed.
I totally agree with that. I think sort of the partisanship in, you know, the way that people sort of the media bubbles, especially on the right, obviously. And so, of course, a lot of conservative supporters just, you know, they would automatically attack the interviewer and not the person like Trump who wasn't getting the questions right.
It's interesting. I was going to tell you, John, that I was talking to a friend of mine who's a cancer scientist because I just finished this Stand Up to Cancer telecast. And so I got to spend a lot of time with scientists, and he lives in Charleston, South Carolina. And I said, you know, how do people in the very red state of South Carolina feel about President Trump? And he said, well, the tariff stuff is really hurting some, you know, the local economy, and they're upset about that. And I said, well, what about some of the other things, reporting about things he's done? And who knows what was happening that week, but I must have raised something. Mm-hmm. And he said, they don't believe a lot of it. They say it's fake news.
Yeah. They don't believe it unless they actually feel it in their own lives or see it in their own lives, you know, which is one reason, like you said, why the tariff issues actually had an impact. I wonder if there's another issue, too. And I also think, by the way, what you said about sexism is absolutely right. I think there are different standards for women who run for office and men who run for office. And I think that is a big reason why the Palin interview was more impactful than a similar interview with Trump. The only other thing I wonder is, and I'd love to hear what you think about this as a journalist and as someone who's interviewed so many people in your career. I think that today, a lot of journalists, when they interview Trump, they sort of have a set of questions and topics that they want to get to. And Trump knows that. And so when they ask one question and he starts dissembling or garbling on and not really answering the question, they know they have, what, like 7 or 8 minutes, and so they quickly move on to the next topic. But I've noticed right. that the interviews that are most successful in terms of sort of exposing Trump's lack of knowledge or preparedness or the fact that he lies quite often are those interviewers who sort of throw away the script and stay on that one topic and go at him again and again and again. And I wonder if you've noticed that too, or sort of how would you prepare for an interview with Donald Trump today, knowing what you know about what his strategy is like during interviews?
I mean, I think I would appeal. Gosh, I haven't really thought of this because I haven't had an opportunity. But I think I would appeal to sort of his behavior and try to understand. I would try to see if there was any recognition or realization that his behavior is grossly inappropriate at times, and you know how he's changed the office mm-hmm. and of the presidency. And I don't think I think I might sort of go to it that way, about sort of decency in a way that didn't put him on his heels, but in a way that I expressed real interest, almost like a therapist. I might go that route, because I think if you present him with facts or figures, he'll just present you with his own facts and figures, right? They'll become null and void. So, you know, I would just like to understand more about the way he's operating and the way he sees his responsibility as the president of the United States. You know, when I see some of his advisors on television, it becomes so confrontational and antagonistic that I feel that sometimes interviewers don't, you know, have an opportunity or don't choose to be a little more artful with how they unpack an issue. You know, if someone makes an assertion, instead of saying they're wrong, I'd like to really get them to explain why they're making that assertion and on what basis. But they never get a chance to kind of have an opportunity to try to explain themselves and to go a few steps, you know, a few inches deeper into any particular issue. And a well-prepared interviewer should, in my opinion, be able to dig a little deeper instead of just focus on the boxing match, if you will.
Yeah, and that's sort of a function of just the way the media has changed over the years, too, because now, you know, there's like 8 heads in little boxes on television all yelling at each other all at once. And it becomes much more difficult to have like
people,
a longer conversation.
You know, they think people are tuning in for the fight, and maybe they are, you know, like who won, who got the better of that person. But for me, it's frustrating and unsatisfying because I don't want to see who got the better of them, you know, who had the pithier comeback. I want to actually understand why they say the things they say and why they think the things they think.
That's interesting. Katie Couric, thank you so much for coming back on Pod Save America. And
it's so fun to talk to you, John.
And when is the documentary out?
It's out Thursday.
Excellent.
It's actually two parts. The first part is kind of the buildup to the interviews and some of the our experiences. Brian and I did it together, for me conducting, him preparing and witnessing it. And then the second part is sort of how she was treated in terms of her gender and how she diverged from John McCain in terms of her campaign style and rhetoric.
Uh-huh.
And really how she paved the way with the lamestream media demonizing the free press in this country, which, you know, I know you agree is just a terrible thing to do.
Yeah.
And so undemocratic and very ill-advised, in my view. So it's sort of like how she paved the way for President Trump and what's happening in today's political landscape.
The documentary is called The Palin Interviews 10 Years Later. I am very excited to listen to this. I can't wait for it to come out. So we'll be taking a listen. Everyone else, take a listen. And thank you, Katie, for joining us.
Okay. Thanks so much, John.
Thanks again to Katie Couric for joining us. Thanks, Aaron and Dan, for being here on this shitty day.
I've been here for so long.
So, Aaron thought she was coming in the morning for a quick
recording. I was like, 10 a.m., then I'll go to my real work, and then nope.
We've just been sitting in the office staring at this thing all day.
Welcome to our job.
Yeah, exactly.
Yay.
Watch cable and tweet.
All right, everyone. We'll see you next week.